Hey everyone, I'm Ashley Banfield. Welcome back to another episode of Drop Dead Serious. I think you're gonna love today's conversation. Honestly, this is one of those conversations that I covet. Super in-depth, really, really informative from one of the smarter people who knows his shit, for lack of a better description. And I wanted to have this conversation with my guest today because there's just so much I don't know, and all of us don't know, that getting inside the mind of a homicide prosecutor really, really sort of helps to get closer. You probably know this, but for the first time since the murders in Moscow, Idaho, thousands of pages of evidence that have been hidden behind a sweeping gag order. I think there will be things that stay under a gag order, and that is for the dignity of the victims, right? But generally speaking, I think the public has been held back so much from a public process, I can't see a real reason to keep the majority of the investigative information secret. But if you're thinking about the work product over the last 2.5 years on that Brian Koberger murder case, search warrants, forensic reports, GPS data, phone records, witness interviews. Wow. I mean, witness interviews, those kids that showed up on the scene that morning and discovered the disastrous situation that befell 1122 King Road. Those are going to be really informative. Basically, every single thing that the public has not been allowed to see. And to break down what we can expect if/when that gag order is lifted, what's at stake, what surprises might actually be waiting in those files, I called Matt Murphy. Matt is a former Orange County prosecutor who has tried some of the most high-profile serial killer and murder cases in California. And he's so insightful because he doesn't just do the job, he really thinks through the job. And he's so analytical. And he followed the Idaho murders from the get-go. And so he has had the same kinds of questions that you and I have had, but way more, like the kinds of questions I might not have even thought to ponder. And so I wanted you to be a part of this conversation with Matt, especially while we're in the crux of possibly finding out the mysteries that have kept us all transfixed by the Idaho murders. Here's Matt and my conversation. I have so many questions. I mean, I think everybody, we all have so many questions, not the least of which is motive. Who knows if we'll ever know that? That's not going to likely be in the gag order. But do you expect that we might actually get somewhere, that there might have been some writings or some digital material that the police found in their investigation that leads us to understand a little bit more of why Brian Koberger did this to these four innocent kids?
Well, I sure hope so. And I, of course, with the gag order in place, a lot of the information that we've had that we've heard has been via rumor. It has not been introduced in anything that's been released yet, nothing in search warrants. But you know, this has all the hallmarks of a psychopath, right? And this is just my opinion here. This is based on my experience, but there are certain hallmarks of this kind of murder. And he appears to have been obsessed with one of these beautiful young women, and he's following her on social media. When the DA was going through some of the facts, it looks like they figured out where he was parking his car. He'd been to the house several times. All that stuff that's been publicly made available to us. But I've heard rumors of certain searches on adult websites. I don't know if that's true or not. But the vast majority of your classic serial killer are you know, they're sexually motivated crimes. Now, whether we're ever going to get those answers or not, I don't know. That has not been made public. But I can tell you, I did 13 of these guys over the course of my 17 years. And there was a sexual component on almost every single one of them. Not every one, but the vast majority. And of course, we see that with the Bundys, with the Dahmers, with the dating gang killer, Rodney Alcala, which was one of mine, with the Golden State Killer, Joseph D'Angelo, also one of mine. Like, there was a sexual component to every one of those. Now, what I thought was very interesting in this is this DA took pains to say there was no sexual assault, but he didn't just leave it at that. He said there was no sexual component. Now, that's a very broad term. I don't know if that meant he was talking about what happened actually at the murder scene, in which case I have no problem believing that. But component, the way he said it, That seems very broad. That no sexual component to me means there's no evidence of a sexual motive. And I don't know. I don't know if it was appropriate for him to say that because I don't think he can tell us or there's any way that he would know what was actually going on in the mind of Koberger when he went into the house.
Or maybe he misused the word. Maybe he did mean at the actual crime scene. And I go through all sorts of scenarios in my mind, not the least of which is that perhaps one person was the target, I think Maddie Mogan. And lo and behold, Kaylee was in the bed as well. So it was a bigger job than he had planned for. And suddenly he might have heard a noise after doing what he did to these two and encountered Zanna Kernodle on the way down the stairs and perhaps walked or chased after her because she'd seen him. And then, lo and behold, after he had taken care of this witness, discovers there's another, a fourth victim who needs to be silenced. I don't know why then he wouldn't have silenced Dylan Mortensen, but maybe he didn't see her. It was dark. So who knows, right? Maybe he had planned to take out Maddie and do something else, but everything went awry and he found himself having to use his very quick mind and his criminal justice to try to take out witnesses quickly and then decided it's time to go. Do you see any validity in that?
Oh, I think that that's, look, and this is just based on what I know that's been released publicly. I think that's spot on. And I've said this before. There's the great philosopher Mike Tyson. Everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face. And I think his plan, he was targeting one. And remember what we learned is that her she sometimes they would sleep in the same bed. And so he walks in expecting to find one, and there's two women there, and the whole thing goes pear-shaped. Whatever his plan was, and I think you're exactly right. And I think it was loud, it was unexpected. There's a dog in there, and now all of a sudden there's this 6'4" awesome young kid, Ethan, who's in the mix. And I think he was surprised by all of that. If I had to guess, I think that that is a very reasonable interpretation of the evidence. And look, this is part of the problem with this gag order. We just don't know. We don't know what information they have yet. And I, for one, can't wait to dive into these reports.
I mean, and let's hope. And I always come back to Papa Roger, and I am so desperate to find out if the police forensically were able to find on any of his devices in Pennsylvania, or back, in Idaho, that there is a connection between him and Papa Roger. Because if that's the case, then I think we're starting to know. He talked about, questioning the audience in the case discussion group, the Idaho Murders Case Discussion Group. He talked about, does anyone think there was a sexual component here? I think he left the sheath behind. I think he drove up the side of the house and then made his entrance through the back. Well, all that turned out to be true. And then he started to red herring the white car. Instead of calling it an Elantra, he just started to call it a white car. Oh, it's nothing to see here. I think if Papa Roger is Brian Koberger, the white Elantra started to make him fearful. He started to realize they're onto me. I need to shut this down and get the hell out, or at least drive people away from thinking about me.
Well, did you see the photos that were released of him in the black hoodie? And then there's another one where he's giving a selfie thumbs up. They were able to time, yeah, they were able to date stamp that and time stamp that to immediately after the murders. I think both of those, and that again has all the hallmarks. There's a thing that you encounter in the prosecution of psychopaths called the Hare psychopathy checklist, and it's a famous psychiatrist, Dr. Hare, who put together a list of the most prevalent personality traits of a psychopath. And one of those is narcissism, grandiosity, lack of empathy. And in Koberger's writings, which were released, remember there was those things that he those
Yep.
letters, he talks about how, the way he speaks about himself, I think that there are forensic psychiatrists and psychologists across the country who are just going, yep, that is kind of your classic American psychopath. And it's that fundamental lack of empathy that really separates those guys from the rest of humanity. And it's also important to remember, Ashley, that a lot of us and a lot of your viewers, we look at these guys and we there's this thing called anthropomorphism, where we put human traits or human thoughts on animals, right? It's almost the same thing. We engage in the same thing when it comes to psychopaths because We project our own guilt, our own feelings, our own, sense of right and wrong on them. And one of the things that you hear most commonly as a prosecutor doing these cases is people will say, the worst thing I think that could happen is they'd have to sit in a cell and think about what they did for the rest of their life, as opposed to the death penalty. They'd have to think about it. And I really don't think these guys do that. I think if they thought like the rest of us, they wouldn't have gone in the first place and murdered their victims, or sexually abused and then murdered their victims. And they don't think like the rest of us. And I think that's it's a very common, it comes from a good place, but people put themselves in that position because if you had a sense of guilt, that's what you or I would do.
It'd be
If we killed
terrible.
somebody, I would beat myself up every single day if I was in a prison cell and it's all I would think about. But they have this distinct lack of empathy. It's one of the psychological traits that has been recognized forever, and it's one of the unique characteristics of these guys. And
It's sad.
it's very
That's sad.
interesting.
I mean, that's very upsetting to think. However, I keep coming back to it sucks to be in a cell. It sucks to be 30 years old, facing at least 60 years, I think, if he lives to 90, facing 60 years of the same monotony every single day. You never wear civilian clothes again. I think that in itself is the worst punishment you can set aside, and you have to live with what you did. I don't think Chris Watts lives with what he did every day. I don't think Brian Koberger will, but they will be horrendously mentally traumatized every day when they open their eyes and see where they are.
I mean, I've never been to a prison in Idaho, but I've been to every state prison in the state of California. As part of my job, we would go and we would do what are called lifer hearings. And a lot of these guys, I hate to say it, but they adjust. They make their friends, they program, they can take classes. I wouldn't be surprised at all if he actually gets his PhD while he's programming. They call it programming. That's going to classes, going to group. He'll get his routine down. He'll have his favorites. He'll have money on his books from his parents. And a lot of them really do, they adjust. Now, again, that's one of those things. For you or me, when we have a life and we've got dynamic friends and people we love, it would be the worst thing ever, right? But for somebody like Brian Koberger, these guys really do tend to adjust. And going to prison was part of the calculated risk when he went into that house. He thought about it.
I'll bet he thought for sure he wouldn't get caught. He thinks he's that smart. But I
Yeah,
will ask
that's right.
this. Would that dynamic be any different were he on death row? I mean, I know the sound death row is like ominous, but would he have just adjusted to that too? And let's be frank. We all know you're on death row for a good 20 years. And maybe after 20 years, we'll have all decided death row isn't appropriate for Americans anymore. Would he have adjusted to that? Would it have been any worse?
Well, death row inmates they have different confinement circumstances, number one. In San Quentin, each one gets their own cell, and they're able to have TV, and they get segregated by different yards. Now, in California, we have over 700 people on death row, and we're realistically probably never going to see another execution in the state of California. Idaho has less than 10. So the difference there is that the one person that every psychopath actually cares about are themselves. And the prospect of looming execution, being a condemned prisoner, I think that it weighs far more heavily on them than just accepting that, hey, I'm here, I got life sentences, and I'm here for life. I'm going to adjust to my new circumstances and take my classes and work in the shop and whatever they have him doing. So I think it is a little bit different. Now, you're right, they do adjust to death row, but I really do think that it's something that specter hanging over their head does have a psychological impact, especially in a state like Idaho, where he faces the very real prospect of actually being executed. Now, they you know the good thing about what the DA did here, and I'm not 100% on board with this decision at all, but the good thing is there really is a exhaustive appellate process on death penalty cases. And my Rodney Alcala case, I tried the third trial on that case. So that family had to go through it three separate times, and it
Dating
destroyed the
game
mother.
killer for those who
Yeah,
don't
the dating
recognize
game killer.
Rodney
That's
Alcala.
right. He had two convictions and two death sentences reversed by the appellate courts in California, and I'm not taking issue with the reasons why they did it, but these cases do get the highest level of appellate scrutiny, as they should, because you're talking about the ultimate penalty. But it is, and it can be brutal for the families. That is all true. On the other hand, there are, and look, I'm not hardcore either way on the death penalty, and I've personally tried eight of them. There are really good reasons against the death penalty that are philosophical and religious, but there are also very good reasons, I believe, for the death penalty. And when we get outside the politics of our time and the screaming heads and all that, like when you have a rational discussion in the middle, and I used to do this at law schools, it can be very interesting. Like when you talk about what is the value of justice, what is the value of the victims' lives? Do we express that? Should the state be involved in executing anybody? Given all of our experiences at the DMV, right? Like, all of those are really
To say
good,
the
healthy things to
least,
talk
that
about.
last point, right? To say the
Oh,
least, we are
right.
so imperfect. Even the best of us are so imperfect. And you don't get a mulligan when you
No,
impose a
you don't
death
get a
penalty.
mulligan. That's right. But I can tell you this. I sat on the Death Penalty Review Committee in Orange County. We called it our Specialist Cert Committee, and I did it for 15 years. And of the murder cases that were eligible for the death, we call them special
Rape.
circumstance cases. Those are murders committed in the course of a robbery, during a rape, gang crimes, drug dealers shooting each other, like all these different things that qualify. We sought death in less than 4% over that 15-year period of time. So the cases that the essentially the two requirements, and it wasn't a formalized thing. We would recommend to the elected DA, and sometimes he followed our recommendations, sometimes he did not. But you, the two fundamental requirements is there has to be zero doubt about guilt, zero doubt, like, and not like the legal definition. Like, you must have zero doubt that the guy did it, and the murder has to be shocking. So it has to be like a murder of a child, like my Samantha Runyon case, or a serial killer like Rodney Alcala,
Heinous,
or
atrocious,
the Golden State
cruel, all
Killer.
of the above.
It has to be exactly. It has to be. It can't be a robbery gone wrong or gang members killing each other. It's not that kind of murder. It's shocking and brutal, where justice essentially demands the ultimate penalty, at least on paper. Whether it's ever carried out or not is a separate issue. And for some family members, especially I'm thinking of the Gonzalez family here, that can be a very cathartic thing to have the jury, as the voice of the community, come in and say, "Mr. Koberger, we are so convinced of your guilt, and you offer you so little in the way of mitigating evidence. That, and these kids were so valuable as human beings, and they're beautiful, and they're on the cusp of their lives, that whether you're ever executed or not, you deserve to die for what you did." There can be solace for certain family members. Other family members, sometimes they may be opposed to the death penalty, religiously, philosophically, politically, and that might be really hard for them. You factor all of those things in when you make the determination at the beginning. And this DA went through that process. And one of the things I'm really looking forward to, and I hope we get the answer to, is what changed. Because I haven't heard anything yet, because he made that decision. That's a very somber, serious, it's the heaviest decision that an elected district attorney will ever be called to make.
I was going to ask
And
you about that because this looked like a slam
what
dunk,
changed?
right? Right? But I do
This
want to ask you, here's what I think might have changed. Maybe, just maybe, we're dealing with four sets of parents, two surviving roommates who I believe should have been part of that mix as well, because this is their lives as well, right? This is the trial they had to stand up and sit on a witness stand in front of millions of people. Maybe the balance of numbers was off. The Gonzalveses absolutely wanted the death penalty. I'm told another family member as well did, but at least two other family members did not. And we don't know about Dylan and Bethany, whether they did not want to go through with this. Does that count the numbers game when it comes to the victims, the surviving victims, the family members? If they're all begging the prosecutor, but for maybe one or two of them, please don't make us go through with this. Does that count?
everything counts. So when a DA makes that decision, it is it he, they should be considering all the fors and against. And the way the law is structured on this is it's a balancing and a weighting of what are called aggravating versus mitigating circumstances. So in the state of California, factors in aggravation are things like the circumstances of the offense, which include the impact on the victim's families, how much they're going to miss their loved one, how valuable they were, whether there's any other crimes of violence in the background, things
Heinous,
like that.
atrocious, and cruel. That's another one.
No, that absolutely. Those are all things that get factored in. And then in the way of mitigation, you consider things like, was the defendant mentally ill? Was the defendant under the influence of drugs? Was the defendant under the dominion or control of another person? Were they doing it? In other words, were they the lightweight in this and somebody else was the main actor? And then in California, as is, federally, there's the same thing. There's a similar provision in Idaho. In California, it's called K-factor evidence, where it's essentially a catch-all. It's any other piece of evidence lawfully admitted that the jury considers to be mitigating or
Yeah.
ameliorating.
Can I tell you,
And then
Matt?
their job is to
That's
assign a weight.
everywhere.
And if, yeah, and the
Literally, in my
standard
career,
is
it's
if
every
the,
state has that last catch-all. You have the nice
that's
big
right.
long list of mitigators, and then you have the last one, which is anything else, folks, which could be,
That's right.
oh,
And,
my Cub Scout leader when I was six wants to talk.
right. And the jury must find that these aggravating factors substantially outweigh any factors in mitigation. And it can't be like 51%. The word is substantially outweigh. So it must kind of overwhelm it. And there's no percentage that's assigned to that. That's the process, but that's the exact same process that the prosecutors go through behind the scenes when they evaluate death, or in California, life without possibility of parole, when you're weighing those two things. So this DA very properly went through that process. I thought it was the right call given the brutality of this case. And I can tell you our committee would have seen this as a death case all day long, because also Brian Koberger, we've heard that he, allegations that he's somewhere on the autism spectrum. There's, whether he is or isn't, and whether that's a factor in mitigation, he's very high functioning. He's getting his PhD. We saw how alert he was in court when he took the plea. And look, a lot of these are, it's battles of the experts, and they can be tough cases. In fact, they're all tough cases. But I want to know what changed, because the defendants all want to plead guilty. They all want LWOP. That's their win. And it's known as a bifurcated trial. So first you have the guilt phase, then the same jury hears evidence regarding penalty. And that's the process. And it's heavy, and it's involved, but when you make the call, I don't know. I
I'm going
think
to tell you,
you go
Matt.
through it. Yeah.
I don't think Brian Koberger thought he'd be convicted. I think he's that egotistical. The kind of guy that goes back to the scene of the crime at 9 in the morning, whether it was to look for the knife sheath outside or not. I think he thinks he's that good. I think he thinks he's that much better than the rest of us, that he could carry this out for his own enjoyment or whatever the hell it was he wanted. And I think he's the kind of guy who said, I'm gonna beat the rap. I don't wanna plead. I gotta beat the rap. And I think maybe when the final blow was dealt to him by the judge in the last, what was it, 2 or 3 weeks before trial, Ann Taylor said, no, there really is nothing left. There really is nothing left. I can't point to other people anymore. The judge said, no, you can't have an alternate perpetrator theory. Brian, you're going down. I feel like that might have been the final decision making, but I think all along, I don't think he would have, this is me talking. I think he would have said, I'm not taking a plea deal. I'm going to beat this.
Well, yeah, I think you, and you may very well be right. And that grandiosity, it being one of those things on the hair psychopathy checklist, there's an arrogance that goes along with a lot of these guys. And there's a myth, Ashley, that we all, I saw Silence of the Lambs, right? You're Buffalo Bill. Another big question you get as a prosecutor is, what could have made him do that? What drove him to that? And we think about that character in Silence of the Lambs, the guy who's murdering women to take their skin because he wants to metamorphosize and the death's head moth and all that stuff. And that was very loosely based on an actual guy. But that's mental illness. The sad kind of scary reality in my experience on these guys is they tend to be exactly what you're talking about. They tend to be intelligent. They tend to be super arrogant, and they don't care about anybody else. There's nothing wrong with their moral compass. They know the difference between right and wrong. They do it because they don't care. So, but that said, with
Well,
this evidence.
more than that, Matt, I believe it's the ultimate in selfishness. They don't care. And their desire to be satiated for whatever whim is going on supersedes everything else. It supersedes morals. It supersedes risk. It supersedes all these other things.
Oh yeah, no, and look, I'll share a story with you if I can. There is, and I'm working on book number two right now, which is focusing on serial killers that I encountered in my career.
Can't wait.
But I went from sexual assault into homicide, and I wound up in homicide. And I was looking for Buffalo Bill, like where's this poor tortured soul that was horribly abused as a child? And what I kept encountering in homicide rape were the same guys that I'd just been prosecuting in sexual. They were the serial, and the personality is so similar. They were the break into the house and put the knife to the throat guy that woman after woman after woman. And those guys had jobs, and they had They had wives and girlfriends, believe it or not, and they had families that cared about him. And like Rodney Alcala, the dating game killer, he's a perfect example of that. This guy grew up, he went to a really good Catholic prep school in East LA, Cantwell High School. We used to play them in sports with my high school. And he had a mother who loved him. He grew up in a clean home. He had a brother who went to West Point, went to Vietnam, came back a war hero, like an officer in Vietnam. Very, very successful family. He had a Mensa level IQ. And this guy had every advantage in life, graduated from UCLA film school and probably murdered 100 people. So that, and was not abused by anybody. And since we had to try the case three times, there were three separate investigations looking for mitigation. And some of the best defense attorneys in California defended that guy, and they couldn't find a thing. So there's that aspect of it. And when it comes to Brian Koberger, you see this guy at the age of 28, he's driving across country in those videos that we have seen that were released with his dad, you know, and he had a functional relationship with parents that had a nuclear household, you know, like his parents, I believe, right? They're still together. And he went and visited
Sure,
him. He's
two
driving
loving,
across country with his dad. I didn't
yeah,
do a cross
two loving
country trip with my
sisters.
dad at 28.
He also has great relationships with his professors. I mean, he was engaged. The students, the one student I interviewed, did I lose you? Uh-oh.
Nope, I got you.
There you go.
Can you
Okay,
hear
good.
me?
Yeah.
Yep.
The one student that I interviewed said that he was great. He was a great partner to be on a project with because he worked so diligently and so hard, and he was great at answering questions and great at communication. So he had a good relationship with men, not so great with women.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's exactly what I'm talking about here. A lot of these guys are socially functional human beings, and it goes against that myth that they're all these loners driving a creepy van on a hill.
Easy to spot.
That's look, yeah, that's why, and that's why they're even scarier, because they could be in line in front of us in Starbucks and we would never know. You
They
know,
can
these
be
are the
your
guys.
husband. They can be your father. They can be,
Yep.
I mean, that's the biggest issue, right? And I think, Matt, honestly, this is why you and I have these conversations. We all are racking our brains with how to spot the thing that doesn't belong in the flock and yet is lurking among us at all times with the same wool.
Yeah, that's right. And that's what makes these guys even scarier than, yeah, I mean they're kind of the quintessential intraspecies predator. That's what they are. And another thing is, if you do a deep dive into the research on this and you really get into the history, there was a, I mean, they were talking about, you know, remember there's an ancient Procrustes, I think his name was. It was a Greek mythological figure. This is going back 3,500 years with the ancient Greeks that were writing about the guy who would kill travelers and rob them and then cut their feet off or stretch them out to make them fit the beds. So even the ancient Greeks were aware of these guys. There's references in ancient Rome. And then if you get into the more modern era, there are specific serial killers that are noted in the literature from the 1600s in Germany. There's a book called Psychopathia Sexualis, written by a guy named Dr. Von Krafft Ebing in 18, I think it was 1886 when he published it. So he was a contemporary of Sigmund Freud. He put serial killers on a relational spectrum of paraphilias, sexual paraphilias. He called them sadistic lust murders. You talk about a loaded term, right? Sadistic lust murders. And this guy, I thought also this is a product of modern American life. You know, I thought that this is something to do with our modern society. Turns out his entire book, where he lists a bunch of them, including Jack the Ripper, that he talks about. And remember, Jack the Ripper was never caught. And I think it's because of exactly what you're talking about. It's that ability to, that guy walked out into the streets of Whitechapel, London, and immediately blended in. And that's why they never caught him, because he, precisely because he wasn't the creepy guy hanging out in the shadows. He put his top hat on and walked out with a cane after butchering those people and blended in instantly. That's why they're so hard to catch. That's why DNA evidence is so important. And that's why in the modern era, I think that, you know, the FBI estimates that at any given time, there are between 25 and 50 active serial killers working in the United States. And today, there's between 25 and 50. And they might be years between kills, or they might be super prolific. And I think that we are, one of the things that we hear a lot is, why were there so many of them in the 70s? And it's a really interesting question. But I think the answer to that is, we're catching a lot more of them now after their first rodeo, so to speak. Not to sound
Great.
glib, but that
No,
is,
I got you.
we're getting them right with that first rodeo. And there really is that blurred line between the serial rapists who sometimes will murder, and I did a bunch of those, versus the ones that actually get off on the killing itself. But they are, it's such a fine line, and it's amorphous. It's a gray area. Sometimes they'll test the murder
Or
and they'll
rape.
do one. But we tend to catch these guys after their first couple of rapes, and they get lengthy prison sentences.
But they
And it's
don't
something for
become
everybody.
legendary because they don't
That's right.
become what they might have become when crime fighting wasn't quite as good.
That's exactly right. And also with the CODIS system, that can't be understated. When every state finally went online, like I had a guy, Jason Balcom, he was that guy. He was a very prolific serial rapist who murdered a woman for fun in broad daylight. Pregnant 22-year-old, beautiful Mormon woman, newlywed, and all she wanted to do is be a mom. Murdered her next to a baby bassinet. Her husband came home and found her there. But we didn't, right? We were unable to. And then he moved to Michigan, where he
Rape.
committed a series of rapes there, was serving 50 years in Michigan for the rapes. Michigan finally went online, and we got a DNA hit to that murder. So that's the way a lot of those work. And he was 18 years old, actually. He was
Oh,
raping
God.
everybody in Santa Ana and Orange County and Costa Mesa. And then he got caught rape within 12 months, and he multiple people. So that I think
Right.
is why we're seeing less of these guys, is because we're getting them after that first couple of reps, as opposed to letting them blossom and evolve into what they want to become.
Let me ask you something about Brian Koberger that I listen, there's so much that, in the last 2.5 years we've been compiling that I keep forgetting things, And something came back to me a while ago where I thought, hold it. This detail from back then, does it make more sense with what we know now? When he was arrested, the minute they slapped the cuffs on him, the first thing out of his mouth was, "Have you arrested anyone else?" And I thought, I wonder what Matt's going to think about that now, given this admission, given everything we've been through, that the first thing out of his mouth was maybe plant the seed that there's somebody else out there because he's crafted a plan for getting caught.
You know, he may, I mean, remember, this is a PhD student in criminology, right? So this is a guy who has thought this through. And that's something that very well might have been a planned thing. He very well might have wondered if there were any other suspects that they'd arrested. He might have wanted to know where he was, if they were looking at a bunch of people and arresting him. It's really difficult to know. But I can tell you the vast majority, and certainly not all, the Hillside Strangler, Angelo Bono, he was active with his cousin doing those. And sometimes these guys will team up. I had another one in Orange County where I had the case for a very short period of time, but it was two serial killers working together, murdering sex workers. And one of them had his court monitor bracelet on his ankle, like his ankle monitor. And so it was the easiest case to look, and there was a he was and they were disposing of the bodies in dumpsters, and then we got their cell phone records. So sometimes they will team up, but there does not appear to be any evidence that Brian Koberger acted with anybody else on it. So I think we should guard against speculation on that. And another thing that you pointed out, I am all for and look, I love the true crime world. The people that I've met in it have been awesome. Like the people at CrimeCon, I love those crowds. And the people that are educating themselves in this area, I think it's a wonderful thing because they're learning about the great work behind the scenes of the crime lab and these dedicated detectives. And there's so much to learn. And I also love the attention to the legal system and the way people learn about things like bifurcated trials. All of that benefits us. However, there is a dark side, and that is some of these online sleuths. And in this case, there's a bunch of people that got together and decided that one of these professors at this school did it. And imagine you're a totally innocent person, or like those four guys that the judge said there's no evidence here. And one of these poor women, her ex-boyfriend was got the spotlight by the online sleuths. And people have
There
to
was one in
remember in the
particular.
in
Let's be clear about this. There was one person in particular who went after that professor and named her as the killer, said she was having a sexual relationship with, I think, one of the girls on the third floor. I mean, just went absolutely off her rocker
Right.
and was sued successfully, but continued, as I understand it, to propagate these lies against this poor professor. And I think then had a following who jumped on board with it. It was the first example of the horrendousness of how some people treated the Idaho murders.
Well, I'll tell you, and this is more I guess more of a personal comment between you and me, but I don't mind saying it. Like, as a DA, with all the death threats that you get, I had no social media for years. Absolutely no social media. And that now that I'm out and I'm in private practice and I'm doing the media stuff, I heard of online trolls before. I really did not appreciate how vicious people can be online until I sort of entered the world. It is unbelievable. I saw an interview where Joe Rogan said, never read the comments. And boy, oh boy, was he right. And they even that group that you were talking about, they started calling themselves Pro Burgers. They like gave themselves a cute little nickname, Pro Burgers. Look, he's not alleged to have committed this murder anymore. He came
He
into
did
court
it.
and he admitted it. The cell phone information was overwhelming, guys. That DNA, and we heard all this stuff about, well, it's transitory and it's circumstantial. I tried 53 murders when I was in the homicide unit. I'm telling you, the evidence against Brian Koberger was absolutely overwhelming from the very beginning. He was going to go down regardless of what he thought. And I think all of those people that were jumping on the pro Brian Koberger bandwagon, he admitted it because he really did it. And they gotta, I hope some of them think twice before they do that again,
Before
because
they do it
innocent people
again.
can get hurt.
And I'll tell you what, you and I can talk till we're blue in the face, but they will continue doing this and they will continue to believe he's innocent for whatever crazy reason. I do want to ask you this, though. Ann Taylor, look, great lawyer, obviously, really, really dogged defense attorney. She went to every crevice and every crack and dug out everything that she possibly could to put in the quiver of arrows, right? But at one point, I feel like I recall her saying something publicly that she believed in his innocence. I get it. You're supposed to give your client a full-throated American defense. I get it. But do you think, Matt, that she really believed this guy was innocent, given all the discovery she went through, the 53 or 56 terabytes?
You know, it's a subjective thought right now. I have very little to offer in the way of criticism of what the defense did here, because they're tasked from the perspective of a defense lawyer. This is the heaviest job you can be given. You're in a state with less than 10 people on death row. You've got a guy that slaughtered four kids, and your task under the American system of justice is to save his life.
Yes.
And that so and she did everything she was supposed to do. Now, there's not only the moral component of that and the ethical professional component of that, but there is in the appellate process, this is what happens in every appeal, Ashley. There are three areas of attack for the appellate lawyers, which are a different set of attorneys than the trial lawyers. They attack the judge for their rulings and for their jury instructions. Almost 100% of the time, they will attack the prosecutor for what's called prosecutorial misconduct, and it gets a little worse every year. It gets a little more venomous every year. I hate that aspect of it, and I think that we're due for a correction on that, because they don't pay prosecutors enough to risk their bar card every time they go to court. And that's a separate thing. But they always, without fail, will accuse the defense of what's known as IAC, or ineffective assistance of counsel, and they will Monday morning quarterback them to death. Okay. And they will Monday morning quarterback that defense team to death. So that's one of the reasons why they have to be so thorough, and they have to bring all these
Wait,
motions.
you said
They have
they Monday morning quarterback the defense team to death? I thought you were saying that they.
they no they attack the judge, they attack the prosecutor, but they Monday morning quarterback the defense team to death. They criticize every decision they made. They like I can tell you right now, one of the main issues on appeal would be their stipulation to tear down the house. That was a guaranteed huge issue. They were going to say that's incompetent, and so it's brutal for anybody that and for those that are really zealously opposed to the death penalty, more power to you. I have nothing but respect. But where that manifests in the appellate process is sometimes you get these lawyers who believe that it's a barbaric punishment. Therefore, any accusation they make against the judge, the prosecutor, or the defense team is therefore morally justified. I disagree with that. I think that it's awful. Look, I've tried, like I said, I've done eight of them against really, really good defense lawyers. Now, one of those is Rodney Alcala, who represented himself. I'll take him out of the mix. But his attorney was a guy named George Peters, who's fantastic and a real dedicated, hardworking, brilliant lawyer. And you go through this, These trials are like wars, and you really get, it's like going 12 rounds with a boxer. You really get a healthy respect for almost everyone, almost everyone. But these defense lawyers really, they work very hard at this. And look, regardless of how you feel about the case or our system of justice, that is a noble thing to do because they're trying to save somebody's life. So
It is. Well, and also
I
not just
really,
save someone's life, they're standing up for American democracy. They're standing up for our
that's right.
system, which is the shining example for the world. They're standing up for your rights, my rights, to not be falsely accused without the most robust fight that Americans can give you. And I look, and I love that. I love that because I've always felt not one person should be put to death who's innocent. You know, and if
Right.
it takes fighting like hell for every single one of them out there that's foul and vile and vicious, that's worth it.
Yep, I totally agree. There's a great HBO documentary where John Adams, Paul Giamatti plays him. It's
I saw it.
fantastic for anybody.
Oh.
It is fantastic. And he gets up and at the very birth of America, I feel like I should be waving a flag right now, but this is true, guys. I believe this. He gets up and he defends a bunch of British soldiers who fired into a crowd of essentially a budding riot, and there were a bunch of kids. They were completely surrounded, and they fired and they killed some Americans. And he got up and he defended them. He's one of the founding fathers. That was one
Mostly
of the prouder.
successfully, I'll
Yeah,
add,
he did.
you
It was one of the prouder moments of American history because for that very reason, exactly what you're talking about. We all deserve a defense if we're accused of something. And look, if we're actually going to carry out the ultimate penalty, which is the death penalty, it should go through that process. They should be given all of those advantages. They should have the catch-all provision. They should have a judge allowing most defenses, not accusing innocent people
know. Right.
without evidence. I think this judge did a very, very good job. So I have very little criticism for the defense here. I have no criticism for the court. I do take issue with some of the things that the DA did in this. As I've said, I think that I would love to hear what changed behind the scenes. I would love to hear what the change of circumstances was. And some of the language that he used in that plea, I did not like. I didn't like how he said, I didn't like his use of the word, when he was talking about sexual assault, that I didn't like the language he used in there because I thought it was very ambiguous. And
Component.
yeah, the component, I didn't like that word because that seems to imply motive. And I'd like to think he wasn't saying that. I'd like to think that he was referring to evidence at the scene that there's no sexual assault. But he didn't say that. He said there's no component. And then he said there was no sexual assault. And component
No.
to me means no porn searches, no evidence at all. I mean, another rumor we heard is that Koberger was obsessed with Ted Bundy. I don't know if that's true. If it is true, though, Ted Bundy viciously, brutally sexually every one of his victims. As again, the FBI did a study on this where a healthy majority of serial killers sexually violated their victims. This is a recognized thing that many of them that don't, that simply kill, even then they're motivated by sexual components. So I again, maybe he knows something that we don't. He knows a lot that I don't because I haven't seen the reports. But I hope that that was just a poor choice of words and he was describing the scene. Otherwise, I take issue with that.
I have one other question for you that I think you specifically, with your background, could at least lend some guidance or expertise or at least a hypothesis on. When we read the probable cause affidavit long ago, the one bizarre piece of evidence that they listed was I think it was like a latent shoe print of blood, tiny, outside of Dylan Mortensen's room. And now, given what we know, right, the killer, Brian Koberger, came in through the back, he went upstairs, he killed the first two victims, Maddie and Kaylee, upstairs, then came down and encountered Zanna somewhere between that staircase and obviously her room where she was killed. I don't understand how there could be just one very small, tiny shoe print of blood and not a river of evidence all the way from the third floor down the second floor, around the corner to Zanna and Ethan, where they were sleeping, and then back out again past Dylan's room a second time and out the kitchen door. Do you think they just left all that out and they only gave us one tiny piece of evidence in the probable cause affidavit to satisfy what they needed? Or does it mean it was almost bloodless everywhere but those two bedrooms?
Well, I think that Look, it's a great observation because I've been to stabbing murder scenes with multiple victims before, and it looks like helter-skelter. The cause of death is known as exsanguination, which means you bleed to death. And when you're talking about a Marine Corps K-bar knife, that is a vicious stabbing instrument. And you're right, the vast majority of time, especially in a struggle, the killer will step in blood. However, it could be that they left that out of the warrant. Shoe print impressions are, it's a fascinating subset of forensic science that I had a case with a guy once who murdered two victims with a knife inside. It was his ex-boyfriend and an ex-boyfriend's lover. It was the defendant's name was Vincent Wei Choi Chung, and he was wearing socks when he snuck into the house. And so we had footprints all over, but they were socked footprints. So we had no Ridgedale detail like fingerprints. And we brought down actually a Mountie from Canada as our expert who testified about it. And it is fascinating. So in this case, again, we just don't know until we see the photos and look for these crime scene photos. I hope for the sake of these families, we never do. I hope
Matt,
that those are never unsealed.
have you ever seen a crime scene, let's just say multiple stabbings, where there isn't helter-skelter, where there isn't blood everywhere, there is only blood where those victims were attacked? Because that's the image I have in my head.
I had a stabbing at a New Year's Eve party where there was very, very little blood on the outside. However, during the autopsy, as soon as they opened my poor victim's chest, all the blood was contained inside his body cavity, basically. And that's where he bled into. So it can happen. I don't think that happened here. I think that there's blood everywhere. Somehow, based on that one line, and I read that just like you did, it appears he did not, it appears that he didn't step in the blood. Now, we don't know for sure again, but sometimes that happens, you know, sometimes it, and you're going to get that if you step in the blood. These kids are on the bed, you know, maybe his shoes never came in contact with it because of the positions they were in. If they were lying down, it's really, really hard to say.
Hunter Johnson was interviewed in an Amazon special that just released, and now it's very clear that Hunter witnessed the horrors of whatever it was on the second floor. I don't know how close he got to seeing Zanna and Ethan, and he didn't tell the documentarians what he saw. But Matt, he had to have told the police everything. He had to have given them that account, and it has to be in the file, hopefully, that, you know, may end up, you know, being ungagged. I'm just wondering how much we will learn about what Hunter really saw.
If that's one of the items that's going to be released, I guarantee there's going to be an entire taped interview. I mean, that exists, I'm certain. These cops did a good job, Ashley, based on everything that I've seen, which means that was recorded. There's probably a videotape of that. There were probably multiple statements at the scene. I'm sure they interviewed him in a more formal setting with you know, video, HD, hopefully, and everything that they could to preserve this evidence. And that, you know, again, these poor kids, the kids, my heart just breaks for these families, for all the families, and the kids that survived it too. They will never be the same. And remember, we were talking about trolling a minute ago. That poor girl, I shouldn't call her a girl, she's a young woman. That poor young woman
Dylan.
that described the bushy eyebrows, you know, these are kids, they're out, you know, they'd all been drinking like a lot of us did in college. And, you know, the last thing she is thinking is that there's, you know, some slaughter because some psycho has gone in and killed everybody upstairs. And she was criticized very harshly online for a while. And
Brutally.
I hope people think better of that. I've felt sorry for that kid since the very beginning of this. And again, like I really hope people online, you're right, they probably won't, but I hope some people think twice and just show a little more empathy for that. That is a kid in the worst circumstance who lost a bunch of her friends.
The
And by the way,
cruelty.
very lucky she didn't get killed too.
Right. And she probably lives with survivor's guilt every day, as does Bethany, who is sleeping downstairs. But the cruelty that the internet leveled upon this poor young woman, and I say kid too, because I've got kids this age and they're kids, you know, they're just kids and they're coming into their adulthood. And you're right. The last thing on your mind would be that there's a maniacal killer tearing apart your friends. You know, that's Truman Capote stuff. Maybe the worst thing she was thinking was that the DoorDash driver was creepy and made his way inside and wanted to pick up something and leave. That would be what's on your mind, and that would be enough to scare the bejesus out of you. So yeah, the lack of empathy from the internet on these kids, I will never get over that. And I won't get over it with Chris Watts' family, you know, Chris Watts' victim's family, Shanann Watts' family. They're continuing to be assailed almost a decade later. I don't get it. I never will get it. But I hope you're right. I hope that they see this and maybe at some point start to feel a little compunction about what they've done and what they've continued to do.
Yeah. Yeah, and also, look, the pro-burger crowd, imagine if you're a family member. And by the way, guys, you're wrong. It came from a good place, but everybody wants to be smart and everybody wants to figure it out. And it's like, you know, we see that from time to time where everybody jumps on a bandwagon. And if you are the victim's family in that, that is brutal for them. And, you know, I'm scolding the ether right now. But I work with families on every one of my cases for 17 years. They all got my personal cell phone number. And that was a huge part of my job. The victim witness people are heroes behind the scenes. And I just, you don't know what these people go through until, God forbid, you go through it yourself. And the idea that you get people for fun and entertainment rallying behind an accused person is brutal when it comes to homicides.
Or a self-admitted one, because you know he's still going to get love letters.
Oh, okay. And it ain't alleged anymore, folks. He's guilty. He admitted it. Wouldn't have done it if he was innocent. He actually did it. We heard him say it in court. Evidence was overwhelming in the first place. And now we'll move on to the victim impact statements that I think will be soul-crushing for these family members. But hopefully there'll be some measure of catharsis. I don't think we're ever going to see the answers that we want, like what was the actual motivation, what was the order. I don't know if Toberger will ever reveal that. And they didn't do it in what's called the factual basis for the plea. It's very legalese. It's just the bare bones. That's another criticism, sorry, that I got of the DA here. I think that he should have gotten more detail out of Brian Koberger in exchange for that plea to at least give the family some answers.
Well, he did say, you know, Bill Thompson did say that he would sit down with the families after the sentencing and fill them in on other things that they had. I don't know if that meant I'll go over the gag order with you first before I lift it. I don't know what he meant by that, but I did want to ask you what you think the prosecution also signed away. For instance, we heard rumors that Brian Koberger's family is going to give a big interview and that Brian himself will give an interview. The family will benefit. They'll be given money. But is there anything that you can do to silence an inmate behind bars and say, nope, you'll never do an interview. You'll never get your say out there. You won't be able to survive in infamy. Is there something they can write? Or is that just un-American?
No, there is. It's called the Son of Sam laws, which passed after the famous serial killer David Berkowitz in New York in the late 70s, Son of Sam. And as a bunch of states adopted some version of this where people that are convicted of violent felonies are prohibited from benefiting from their crimes by writing books, by giving interviews. Yeah,
that part I get. And that's been around for a long time, but they still benefit because they get out there and they get their message out and they get their face out there and they feel like they're the subject of books and movies and conversations like we're having.
Yeah. Well, look, we just saw this with the Menendez brothers, you know, and I've got some strong opinions on that case that are somewhat controversial and among some, I don't care.
You've told me those opinions before.
Yeah.
It's another podcast.
Another podcast. A lot of whether or not interviews can be conducted of inmates depends on the Department of Corrections in whatever state. It varies by state by state. And then while they're in the jail, it varies by county. Some will allow it, some won't. Some get to do interviews, some don't. So it'd be interesting to see what happens here. I personally don't want to hear from Brian Koberger myself. At sentencing, he may be given an opportunity to do what's called a statement in allocution. That's never satisfying for the families. We might
I
see him
wonder though,
apologize.
I feel the same way you do. I feel like I never want to hear from him again. I want him to go into a cell and just atrophy mentally and physically. However, the other side of me, who has worked in this business for probably as long as you have, because as I found out today, you're exactly my same age. I want to know more so that the rest of us can maybe, as we go through our evolution, spot these wolves in sheep's clothing, find the red flags. Do you know what I mean? Like it's a love-hate relationship I have with knowing more about people like Brent
No,
Coburn.
I totally get that. I mean, and look, it's fascinating. I think that some of it actually really is, it's a primal instinct that we all have. We want to do exactly what you just said. It's a survival thing. We want to be able to spot the predator in the crowd. I would love to crack the code of these guys. My second book is going to be descending into that, like trying to figure it out as best I can. But it is, they are charming a lot of times. They are superficially engaging. They, they're watch the Ted Bundy tapes. And I mean, that guy was a monster, and yet nobody knew it. And that's the challenge. I hope we get there, and I'm with you. I wish we could figure that out. I wish there was some like stamp we could put on these guys, or maybe they're born with some sort of birthmark. But they're just not. And that's why Jack the Ripper was never found. That's why Rex Heurman allegedly, he's been accused, but that guy was an architect with a family, a BTK killer family. Rodney Alcala had girlfriends. Joseph D'Angelo, the Golden State Killer, had a family and kids. They're really,
Was a
I'm with you
cop.
there. It's
Joseph D'Angelo was a
fascinating.
cop, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
How
That's
the
right. He
hell are
was a
you ever
police officer.
supposed to spot them if there's one amongst us is a
Yep.
cop? Okay, so I have one last question for you. And I don't know if it's a question or just an observation, but I've witnessed a lot of victims' impact statements, and they are gut-wrenching, as you said. I don't know how many convicted murderers are if affected in any way by the victim's family members' pain and grief in court. I almost wonder if it's more effective to have a statement read by someone else, meaning family members don't even show up. And a statement is almost one line that says, I actually don't care about you. And that's it. Like that to
Yeah.
me would hurt Brian Koberger more than anything. I don't care about you.
I think you're right in the sense that the best thing or the worst thing for him, the best thing for everybody else would be if he's forgotten about, but I don't think he ever will be. And I think that the real value of that when the family comes in is they're able to say it. The defendant is compelled to sit there and he's got to listen. And whether he cares or not, they at least get to express it. I think that the DA, look, and I don't know what happened behind the scenes here. If what the Gonzalez family said that they were notified via email 48 hours before that plea, I'll tell you right now, and I don't know if that's true, that should never, ever happen. In California and a lot of other states that have adopted what's called Marcy's Law, that would be a violation of their rights. So I don't know what happened, but if they've said words to that effect, and to that extent, I think that for the Gonzalez family, especially that poor dad, I think that he may get as much out of making his statement with the DA having to listen as Koberger sitting there too, because I think they've publicly said they feel betrayed. I believe that was the word they used. And look, this DA has a really rough job, and I want to be fair. The elected DA making these decisions is an incredibly tough job, and trying to balance justice with the victims, with withering, attention in the media. That's really, really tough. And I believe he believes he did the right thing. He's got people from the bleachers like me that are criticizing some of the things he does, and I don't want to be unfair. On the other hand, that's why they pay you the big bucks, buddy, and that's why that's a part of the job. And dealing with difficult family members is a part of the job. And my heart goes out to the victims' families above and beyond anybody else.
Matt Murphy, I could talk to you for days and days, which is why I'm going to call you again. Thank you so much for all
All
of
right.
this.
Happy to come on anytime, Ashley. I love your show.
My great thanks to Matt Murphy. I love having conversations with him. I do so on my Banfield show on News Nation and at CrimeCon. Every chance I get, I try to pick Matt Murphy's brain. And I'll tell you what, I had like so many other questions for him, but the conversation was longer than I expected. And I really mean it when I'm going to call him back. And maybe when the sentencing happens and we do find out what we're going to learn, I will have Matt back and we can parse what we didn't know, what we do know, and whether it's at all satisfying. Because honestly, the public deserves to know. We really do. It's our process. It's our democracy. This is our government. This is our judicial process. These are our fellow citizens. These are our fellow Americans. These are people who walk among us. These are our neighbors. And we deserve to know when and how we can be the most safe with our families, our friends, and our loved ones. And all that comes from information. It really does. And so much more. Anyway, thank you so much for being a part of this community. I can't tell you how much I appreciate that you're here all the time. If you're watching, thank you for watching. If you're listening, thank you for listening. And remember, I always say it, the truth isn't just serious, it's drop dead serious.